This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents The Crown, The Official Companion, by Robert Lacey. Read for you by Alex Jennings.
Forward by Peter Morgan. What is real and what is imagined? What is truth and what is fiction? What happened? What did not? It's become clear that many viewers, while watching The Crown, did so while scrolling through the pages of Wikipedia, searching for answers to these questions. It was an extraordinary pleasure to write The Crown, to anatomize the many vivid characters and events that make up the story in the years 1947 to 1955. But it was sheer agony to condense 10 dramatic, event-filled years of history into just 10 hours of television. So I was delighted by the suggestion that the royal historian Robert Lacey should take up the challenge to clear things up and separate fact from fiction, while telling us a great deal more. So let me hand you over to Robert to take you back to 1947, when the king realizes he is gravely ill, and his eldest daughter, the shy 21-year-old Princess Elizabeth, is about to marry a handsome but fractious young foreigner of whom nobody seems comfortably sure. Chapter 1. Wolferton Splash. Love and Marriage. Buckingham Palace, 1947, reads the caption, and episode 1 of The Crown takes us straight inside it to discover the cancer-stricken King George VI leaning over a lavatory bowl, painfully coughing up his life's blood. The king is dying, made ready for the queen. Kneeling in the palace throne room is Lieutenant Philip Mountbatten, RN, lean and threadbare in his wartime uniform, ready to be ennobled before his wedding to Princess Elizabeth the next day. The Lord Chancellor, the Earl Marshal, and a row of stern establishment faces look on as the ailing monarch takes hold of the sword that will transform his future son-in-law from commoner to royal, their eyes darting with alarm as the king starts to stutter. Then George VI gamely clenches his jaw, twists his tongue around Philip's trio of titles, and rounds off the list with the highest honour in his gift, the Order of the Garter, with which Edward III first knighted his fighting companions in 1348. His Majesty has been pleased to authorise the use of the prefix His Royal Highness by Lieutenant Philip Mountbatten, reported the Times next day, 20th of November, 1947, and to approve that the dignity of a dukedom of the United Kingdom be conferred upon him by the name, style and title of Baron Greenwich of Greenwich, a tribute to Philip's naval background, Earl of Merioneth, a nod to Wales, and Duke of Edinburgh, a traditional royal dukedom and a compliment to Scotland. The king touched Lieutenant Mountbatten on each shoulder with a sword as he knelt before him in the ceremony of the accolade of knighthood and invested him with the insignia of the Order of the Garter. Which is all pretty much as we see things on the screen. The foreigner had been made familiar, with just one difference. As a prelude to the investiture scene, we watch His Royal Highness Prince Philip of Greece and Denmark renounce his Greek nationality and all foreign titles to become a British citizen. The obscure and dubious foreign prince becomes a brave British war hero in front of our eyes. In reality, however, Philip had already become a British citizen earlier that year via the routine form-filling legal process, and certainly not inside Buckingham Palace. History records that Prince Philip of Greece renounced his Greek titles to receive his British citizenship on the 18th of March 1947 under the British Nationality and Status of Aliens Act, so he went by the name of plain Lieutenant Philip Mountbatten, RN, for a full 8 months before his father-in-law ennobled him that November. You are watching an historical drama, dear listener, not a history documentary. The Crown is a work of creative fiction that has been inspired by the wisdom and spirit of real events. To understand Philip, we need to witness his renunciation of his foreign royal status at the very moment we first meet him, the better to savour his full entry into the House of Windsor the next day. What you see on the screen is both truth and invention, in the age-old tradition of historical drama. Friedrich Schiller's revered and much-translated Maria Stuart, first staged in 1800, is often cited as the classic example of a history play, depicting the bitter clash of personalities where Mary, Queen of Scots, came face to face with Queen Elizabeth I, except that in history, the two women never met. As this book will demonstrate, The Crown is based on meticulous factual research, but it is also a TV show, an artfully arranged assemblage of pixels whose purpose is to entertain, to explore great characters and themes in the life of a nation, and to winkle out the meaning of extraordinary events. The ultimate power of the ancient and modern British monarchy lies in its capacity to generate heartfelt emotion, sometimes angry and hostile, but more usually curious and admiring, and always sentimental to an extraordinary degree. Of the various forms of government that have prevailed in the world, wrote the historian Edward Gibbon, an hereditary monarchy seems to present the fairest scope for ridicule. These are the paradoxes that Peter Morgan seeks to address in The Crown, whose drama revolves around two very real people, Elizabeth Windsor and Philip Mountbatten, and the extraordinary lifetime's adventure on which they embark together. It's the dramatization of a seven-decade relationship, a love story that is both simple and highly complicated. So that is why episode one of the series does not begin with the accession of Queen Elizabeth II in February 1952, nor with her solemn crowning in June the following year, grand constitutional landmarks though both events were. We first meet Elizabeth half a decade earlier, on the eve of her wedding to Philip. In reality, neither of the couple has ever been quite sure precisely where and when they first met. But they do recall exactly when they first took serious notice of each other.
"We may have met before,"
wrote Princess Elizabeth in 1947, trying to be helpful in response to a court correspondent's request,
"at the coronation
of George VI in May 1937,
or the Duchess of Kent's wedding
in November 1934. As direct descendants of Queen Victoria, Elizabeth and Philip were both children of the glamorous and fading miasma of 19th-century European royalty that still gathered for such events.
"But the first time I remember meeting Philip,"
wrote Elizabeth, heavily underlining the word remember,
"was at the Royal Naval College, Dartmouth, in July 1939, just before the war."
The meeting had been masterminded by George VI's cousin, Lord Louis Dicky Mountbatten, who, like the king, had trained at Dartmouth as a naval cadet. The Mountbatten destiny had been intertwined with that of the House of Windsor since the reign of Queen Victoria. Dicky, like George VI, was one of her great-grandchildren, and his father, Louis, had been First Lord of the Admiralty at the outbreak of the First World War. But though this elder Louis had risen to First Lord on merit after 46 years of patriotic naval service, he was German by birth, and less than 3 months after hostilities started, he had been hounded out of office during the popular witch hunt against all things Teutonic, from German sausages to sausage dogs. The ties between Windsor and Mountbatten had been bound yet closer by this younger Louis, who had been with the new George VI on the sad evening in December 1936, when the two men had stood and watched the recently abdicated Edward VIII pack his bags to go into exile.
"Diggy, this is absolutely terrible,"
Mountbatten recalled the new king saying, close to tears.
"I'm only a naval officer. It's the only thing I know about."
"That is a very curious coincidence,"
Lord Mountbatten replied,
"for my father once told me that when the Duke of Clarence died,
in 1892,
your father,
the future George V,
came to him and said almost the same things that you have said to me now, and my father answered, 'George, you're wrong. There is no more fitting preparation for a king than to have been trained in the navy.
In 1939, at Dartmouth, the two cousins shared the pleasure of reliving their naval training, while two more distant and younger cousins, Elizabeth and Philip, got to know each other over a game of croquet. Born on the island of Corfu in June 1921, Philip, Prince of Greece, ash blonde and angular like a Viking, had not a drop of Greek blood in his veins. He was a Dane, one of the exports to Greece of the most successful exporting dynasty of modern times, the Danish royal house, known to genealogists as the Schleswig-Holstein-Sonderburg-Glücksburgs.
"You don't look like a bloody Greek to me,"
said Mike Parker, a young Australian who met Philip when they both served on naval convoy duty during the war and would later become his close friend and private secretary.
"I'm part Danish, part German and part Russian," explained Philip. "I can go to practically any country in Europe and there's a relation there I can stay with."
He needed the hospitality. His father, Prince Andrew, was exiled from Greece in December 1922 in one of the frequent ups and downs of Greek politics, and the family fled Corfu in a British warship, carrying the 18-month-old Philip in an orange box. Philip's mother was Alice, the beautiful, deaf daughter of Queen Victoria's granddaughter, Victoria of Hesse, who had married Louis of Battenberg, the ill-treated sea lord and first of the Mountbattens. This mixture from the gene pool of European royalty lay at the root of Philip's self-assurance, which he displayed at that first meeting in Dartmouth to the evident liking of Princess Elizabeth.
"She is shy and he is not," explained one of their friends. "That is the fundamental dynamic of their relationship. He gives her ginger."
After that 1939 encounter, and through his years of wartime naval service, Philip wrote letters to Elizabeth, from here and there, on what he later described as kind of family relationship terms, always downplaying suggestions of any romantic understanding with his younger cousin.
"I thought not all that much about it," he told his official biographer, Basil Boothroyd. "We used to correspond occasionally."
But cousin Elizabeth saw things very differently. Nearly 20 years later, Sir John Wheeler Bennett published his official biography of her father, George VI, a work commissioned and scrutinised, word for word, by Queen Elizabeth II. And although it might have been politic for such a biographer to play down any impression of infatuation on the part of the Queen at such an early age, Sir John's royally approved verdict was emphatic on the subject of Prince Philip of Greece. This was the man with whom Princess Elizabeth had been in love from their first meeting. Old Queen Mary, Elizabeth's grandmother, was taking a close interest. The couple had been in love for the last 18 months, in fact longer, I think, she confided in 1944 to her lady-in-waiting, the Countess of Airlie. The old queen had a soft spot for Philip, remembering him as a nice little boy with very blue eyes, who had come to tea when she lived in Buckingham Palace. From the start of the war, she had honoured him with a place on her knitting list, one of the favoured relatives for whom she crocheted woollen scarves. The princess's mother, Queen Elizabeth, was not so sure. She would have welcomed more evidence of reticence to balance Philip's bumptiousness, and she didn't like his politics, which veered too far to port, leftwards, in her opinion, in the subversive tradition of his uncle Dicky. War's isolation had left her daughter unqualified to make such a major commitment at an early age, she felt, and she took to inviting well-born young guards officers to Windsor for the weekends, the future Dukes of Grafton and Buccleuch, and Henry Herbert, Lord Porchester, the future Earl of Carnarvon. These handsome heirs to ancient estates had the style the Queen thought suitable for her daughter, and the Princess enjoyed their company. Several of them did indeed become staples of her social circle in later years, particularly Henry Herbert, Porchy, with whom the princess had already established a friendship based on their shared love of horses. But none of the Queen's first 11, as intimates slyly called them, had the bounce and excitement of Philip.
"Everyone was starting to say that he could be the one," remembered Edward Ford,
later one of Elizabeth's assistant private secretaries. But he wasn't deferential or ingratiating. He behaved with all the self-confidence of a naval officer who'd had a good war. He wasn't in the least afraid to tell Lord Salisbury, the senior Conservative politician, what his own opinions were. The Salisburys and the hunting and shooting aristocrats around the King and Queen did not like him at all, remembered Mike Parker. And the same went for Tommy Lascelles and the old-time courtiers. They were absolutely bloody to him. But the groundswell only made Elizabeth the more determined. In the summer of 1946, Philip took a few weeks' leave from his teaching duties to join the royal family's annual Scottish holiday, and there, according to legend, in a picturesque spot in the hills overlooking Balmoral, he formally proposed and was accepted. Elizabeth would be 21 on her next birthday, and she had waited as her parents had requested. But she knew whom she loved and whom she wanted.
"I suppose one thing led to another," Philip later explained to his biographer, determinedly downplaying the romance. "It was sort of fixed up."
Practicalities ruled when it came to making the news public. Buckingham Palace had two priorities in the aftermath of victory: to thank the countries of the Empire for their support in the war, and to restore the overtaxed health of the King. And the two objectives were neatly combined in a family tour to South Africa scheduled for the spring of 1947. George VI had set his heart on this sunny foreign foray by the family unit he liked to call Us Four, and there was no room in this picture for a son-in-law. A compromise was reached. The King consented to his daughter's engagement, but it must remain a secret until after the tour. That October, Elizabeth and Philip attended the wedding of Lord Mountbatten's daughter, Patricia, in the parish church of Romsey in Hampshire, and they played the game of keeping a public distance from each other.
"When I come back,"
said Elizabeth to her grandmother's old friend, Lady Early, thanking her for an early 21st birthday present,
"we will have a celebration. Maybe two celebrations."
The South African tour was a triumph for Elizabeth, culminating in her coming-of-age dedication, broadcast on the evening of the 1st of April, 1947.
"I declare before you all," she enunciated in her clear young voice, "that my whole life, whether it be long or short, shall be devoted to your service, and the service of our great imperial commonwealth, to which we all belong. But I shall not have the strength to carry out this resolution unless you join in it with me, as I now invite you to do. I know that your support will be unfailingly given."
The broadcast had been drafted by Tommy Lascelles, George VI's severe and traditional private secretary, whose own summing up of the tour gave pride of place to Elizabeth.
"She has come on in the most surprising way, and all in the right direction," he noted in his diary. "When necessary, she can take on the old bores with much of her mother's skill, and never spares herself in that exhausting part of royal duty. For a child of her years, she has got an astonishing solicitude for other people's comfort."
This consideration for the convenience of others, noted the private secretary, who had served George V, Edward VIII, and George VI, not to mention Queen Mary and the apparently charming Queen Elizabeth, is not a normal characteristic of their family. Princess Elizabeth had come of age. She was ready, and she needed to be. When George VI returned from his 1947 tour of South Africa, he was looking and feeling dreadful. In his 12 weeks away, he had lost 17 pounds in weight. He suffered from painful cramps in his legs, and his secretaries would find him in his study, kicking his feet against the desk to try to restore circulation, signs of the arteriosclerosis that came from his smoking and the restriction of blood flow to his lower limbs. The King's immediate symptom was a peppery temper that was fiercer than ever, and an obstinate refusal to accept that the time had finally come for his daughter to marry Philip. Elizabeth and Philip, for their parts, were more in love and more determined than ever. Early in June 1947, Philip wrote assuagingly to his prospective mother-in-law to concede that delaying their plans until after the South African tour had been correct. But now he and the princess wanted to start their new life together. Elizabeth's personal conviction was the decisive factor. Whatever her parents' doubts, she herself had none, and she was now 21, an adult who declined to accept further delay. The dutiful daughter finally put her foot down, and faced with her resolve, her parents bowed to the inevitable. "She has known him ever since she was 12," wrote the still worried Queen on the 7th of July 1947 to her sister May, "very secretly," underlined in both black and red. "I think she is really fond of him, and I do pray that she will be very happy." 3 days later, the secret was revealed. "It is with the greatest pleasure," read a statement from Buckingham Palace, "that the King and Queen announce the betrothal of their dearly beloved daughter, the Princess Elizabeth, to Lieutenant Philip Mountbatten, R.N., to which union the King has gladly given his consent." "They both came to see me after luncheon, looking radiant," wrote a delighted Queen Mary, who gave her granddaughter some family jewellery. Mabel Airlie was impressed by how Philip's worn uniform reflected the country's current austerity. "The usual after-the-war look. I liked him for not having got a new one for the occasion, as many men would have done, to make an impression." Life was tough in post-war Britain. Wartime rationing restrictions still applied. Clothing, like food, could only be purchased with coupons from a government-issued ration book, and the officially encouraged atmosphere of make-do and mend raised tricky questions about the proper scale of the forthcoming royal wedding. For Princess Elizabeth, sharing her joy with a nation meant sharing its grumbling as well. The cost and style of royal celebrations would provide a theme of national fractiousness throughout her reign, though it was Aneurin Bevan, the beating heart of Labour's left wing, who put the controversy in context. "As long as we have a monarchy," he declared, "the monarchy's work has got to be done well." That proved to be the national consensus by the time the wedding day rolled around on the 20th of November 1947. The list of over 1,500 wedding gifts displayed extraordinary generosity from ordinary members of the public, with many women saving up their ration coupons to send the princess the most coveted feminine asset of the times. 351, Mrs. David Mudd, a pair of nylon stockings. 352, Miss Ethel Newcomb, a piece of old lace. 353, Mrs. E. Clarood, a pair of nylon stockings. People who had been running for their lives into bomb shelters a few years earlier could now celebrate and laugh in the streets. It was, in the words of the historian Ben Pimlott, a kind of victory parade for liberty, and for the constitutional monarchy as well. "Affection for a king's person and family," wrote G.M. Trevelyan in the official programme to the wedding, "adds warmth and drama to every man's rational awareness of his country's political unity and historic tradition. It is a kind of popular poetry in these prosaic times." The wedding helped the family reconcile their differences. "I was so proud of you and thrilled at having you so close to me on our long walk in Westminster Abbey," wrote the King to his daughter after the ceremony. "But when I handed your hand to the Archbishop, I felt that I had lost something very precious. I am so glad you wrote and told Mummy that you think the long wait before your engagement and the long time before the wedding was for the best. I can see that you are sublimely happy with Philip, which is right. But don't forget us, is the wish of your ever-loving and devoted Papa." All was forgiven as far as Elizabeth was concerned. "Darling Mummy," she wrote on the second day of the couple's honeymoon at Broadlands, the Mountbatten estate in Hampshire, "I don't know where to begin this letter or what to say, but I know I must write it somehow because I feel so much about it. I think I've got the best mother and father in the world, and I only hope that I can bring up my children in the happy atmosphere of love and fairness which Margaret and I have grown up in." The arrival of a healthy son and heir within less than a year completed the family and the national joy. Prince Charles was born on the 14th of November 1948, and Princess Anne less than 2 years later.
heavenly little creatures, according to their doting grandmother. I can't tell you what a difference it makes, having them in the house. Everybody loves them so, and they cheer us up more than I can say. Thank you very, very much for letting them come.
The reason why the baby prince and princess were staying with their grandparents at Royal Lodge in Windsor Great Park at the start of 1951 was because their mother was abroad enjoying an interlude unlike any other in her life, the closest she would ever come to everyday existence. Philip's naval career, which both he and the palace felt he should continue to pursue, had taken him to the Mediterranean island of Malta on active service, and Elizabeth went along too. For three spells that added up to nearly a year, she could do relatively ordinary things, such as sunbathe and swim off a beach, drive her own car, and visit Tony's hairdressing salon in Shima every 10 days for a 6-shilling shampoo and set. On Saturday nights, the princess and the duke would join other naval couples for dinner dances in the ballroom of the Hotel Phoenicia, where Philip enjoyed Duke Ellington, take the A-train, while Elizabeth shook a lively leg in the Samba. Not surprisingly, after all their Balmoral evenings, the couple both excelled at the eightsome reel. They were so relaxed and free, coming and going as they pleased, recalled John Dean, Philip's valet of these Malta adventures. I think it was their happiest time. Philip, meanwhile, had achieved his long-standing ambition to captain a ship of his own. After a few months as first lieutenant on HMS Checkers, a C-class destroyer, he was given command of HMS Magpie, a frigate in Britain's still considerable Mediterranean fleet. Dukey, as he was known behind his back, soon impressed his crew with his seamanship skills, negotiating difficult shallows or turning the ship with precision. Philip made clear to his men that royal titles were never to be used, and he impressed still more when he stripped to the waist to row stroke in one of the frigate's whalers, leading his crew to victory in the fleet's annual regatta in which Magpie won 6 of the 10 boat events. In February 1951, Dukey and his wife, a frequent visitor to the ship, were said to be investigating married quarters ashore with a nursery so they could bring their 2 children out to live with them. But back in London, George VI's health was worsening. When he opened the Festival of Britain exhibition on the south bank of the Thames in May 1951, the 55-year-old king looked worn beyond his years and had to retire to bed soon afterwards, suffering from what appeared to be an attack of flu. X-rays revealed a shadow on his left lung, which his doctors told him was pneumonitis, a less severe form of pneumonia which could be treated with penicillin injections. The king was a good patient, taking careful notes of his symptoms to help his conversations with his doctors. He was a particular believer in the homeopathic prescriptions of his beloved Dr. Weir, and had even named one of his racehorses, Hypericum, after a homeopathic remedy that Weir had prescribed him. But as the weeks went by, the monarch remained reluctantly bedridden, unable to chuck out the bug, as he put it, and Elizabeth returned from Malta to help with the traditional royal duties of the summer. Early in June, she read the speech of welcome at the banquet to honour the visiting King Haakon of Norway, then took her father's place at his official birthday celebration, trooping the colour on Horse Guards Parade, riding Winston, a 16-hand chestnut gelding that George VI had ridden in previous years. "It must have been an ordeal for her," wrote Queen Mary to the king. "But she was so calm and collected all through the ceremony. It was really a pleasure to watch her." Towards the end of July, Philip returned to Clarence House, the London family and office headquarters that he and Elizabeth had renovated for themselves on the Mall. "It will be a long time before I want those again," he said regretfully, as he watched his valet unpack and hang up his white naval uniforms. The couple were due to tour Canada in the autumn, and it already looked likely that they would have to take the place of the King and Queen on the long royal tour to Kenya, Ceylon, Australia, and New Zealand that was scheduled for the following year. The hope had been that some winter months in the sun would fortify the King's health, but he was still not able to shake off his cough. Further tests in September confirmed the doctor's worst fears, and an operation was recommended.
"If it's going to help me to get well again, I don't mind," said the king. "But the very idea of the surgeon's knife."
Going into hospital would only intensify the royal hyper-anxiety, so his surgeons decided to create an exact replica of Westminster Hospital's principal operating theatre inside the palace, moving an adjustable operating table, gas and oxygen cylinders, high-intensity lighting and sterilising equipment into the high-ceilinged Boulle guest suite on the first floor looking out onto the Mall. To ensure peace and quiet for their patient, they asked for the daily changing of the guard ceremony in the front courtyard outside to be moved down to St. James's Palace, both during the operation and for the several weeks of bed rest that followed. The king was told that structural changes had necessitated the removal of his entire left lung, and he did not inquire what those changes might be. But Winston Churchill, getting ready to fight a general election the following month, asked his own doctor, Charles Moran, why the specialists had spoken in such vague terms.
"Because," replied Moran, "they were anxious to avoid talking about cancer."
The C-word was never mentioned to the king or the queen, nor to anyone else in the royal family, though the process of removing the left lung on the 23rd of September made clear to the surgeons that the right lung was now infected as well. On the brightest prognosis, George VI had only a few months left to live. On the evening of the operation, during which a crowd of more than 5,000 people had stood in silent vigil outside Buckingham Palace, the diarist, Harold Nicholson, received a phone call from Wilson Harris, the editor of The Spectator, asking him to write an obituary of the king on the basis of Charles Moran's suspicions. Moran would later tell Wilson Harris that, even if the king recovers, he can scarcely live more than a year. "The king is pretty bad," noted Nicholson the following day. "Nobody can talk about anything else, and the election is forgotten. What a strange thing is monarchy." Early in October, the king was still not strong enough to get out of bed to attend the Privy Council meeting that was necessary to approve the formalities proroguing Parliament prior to the election. So, on the 5th of October, a small delegation of Privy Councillors gathered round his bedroom door while the Lord President read out the order of business. Speaking with difficulty, George VI muttered the word "approved," while Lascelles took the necessary documents to his bedside for a shaky royal signature. As events turned out, the narrow election victory on the 25th of October of his old friend and wartime companion, Winston Churchill, seemed to regalvanise the monarch. When Churchill submitted his list of proposed ministerial appointments in his new cabinet, George VI's sharp eye spotted that Anthony Eden's title of Foreign Secretary was followed by the words Deputy Prime Minister, Churchill's sop to pacify his ambitious number two. The king struck out the words of this title imperiously, since they infringed, in his opinion, on his royal prerogative to choose a successor in the event of the Prime Minister dying in office or resigning, and as the weeks went by, his own recovery continued. On the 14th of November, he was fit enough to attend Prince Charles's third birthday party, being photographed on a sofa sitting happily beside his grandson. A preordained political succession might be taboo, but the royal succession flourished. That December, George VI was able to write and pre-record his annual Christmas broadcast before heading out to Sandringham for the traditional Christmas festivities with his family. The sportsman sovereign seemed back to his old self as he enjoyed several energetic weeks of the midwinter shooting that he loved so well. But when his daughter and her husband set off for Kenya on the last day of January 1952, ready to start on the long southern odyssey that the king and his wife had been due to carry out, Princess Elizabeth's private secretary, Martin Charteris, carried sealed envelopes containing a draft accession declaration in his briefcase, together with a message to both Houses of Parliament. King George VI, 1895 to 1952, played by Jared Harris. The VC, Victoria Cross, is Britain's supreme award for battlefield bravery. In September 1940, at the height of the Blitz, King George VI created the George Cross for civilian valour, and it became an apt metaphor for his life. With his infant legs strapped into painful splints to prevent the public dishonour of knock knees, while enduring daily correction from his gruff father, George V, it was small wonder that Bertie had developed a stammer by the age of 8. Between them, his wife, Elizabeth Bowes Lyon, and his Australian speech therapist, Lionel Logue, restored self-belief to his heart and tongue.
"I broke down and sobbed like a child," confessed the new king privately over the 1936 abdication of his brilliant, overshadowing elder brother.
But in public, the stoicism with which George VI battled his evident shyness and speech handicap showed monarchy with a fallibly human face. Winston Churchill's funeral tribute to the king was a wreath of white lilies and carnations in the distinctive shape of a George Cross. Lord Louis Dicky Mountbatten, 1st Earl Mountbatten of Burma, 1900 to 1979, played by Greg Wise. The leanly handsome, charming and shamelessly pushy Louis Mountbatten could take some credit for his nephew Philip's jackpot marriage, and he frequently did. Born royal but not very royal, Uncle Dicky got even closer to the inner circle in his later years as mentor and honorary grandfather to Prince Charles. In fact, he had no Richard among his names, having been christened Louis Francis Albert Victor Nicholas. The family explanation was that Dicky had been an alteration of the last of these, to distinguish him from his uncle Nicky, Tsar Nicholas II. His wartime naval career won him distinction in Burma, modern Myanmar, but his greater achievement came in 1947-48 as the last Viceroy of India, where his energies reduced at least some of the killing in the bloodthirsty partition of India and Pakistan. The IRA thought they'd scored a famous victory when they blew up Uncle Dicky on a family fishing expedition off County Sligo in August 1979, but the bombers actually handed him the hero's farewell, of which he could only have dreamed. The most grudging critics of Mountbatten's ego had to admit it was his due. Sir John Weir, homeopathic doctor, 1879-1971, played by James Laurenson. The bedside manner of Sir John Weir, physician to George VI and Queen Mary, relied on a pocket notebook of porky jokes and wee stories that he would relate to his patients in his Scottish accent. But their faith in him rested primarily on a shared belief in homeopathy, the alternative medicine that seeks to use the body's own abilities to heal itself. Homeopathy, Weir liked to argue, is no religion, no sect, no fad, no humbug. Its small doses of often herbal remedies merely stimulate the vital reactions of the patient, and this causes him to cure himself. Courtiers like Dermot Morra, the royal historian, dismissed Weir as an old menace whose quack remedies did his royal patients more harm than good. But Queen Elizabeth the Queen Mother and Princess Alice, Duchess of Gloucester, were two of Weir's patients who lived comfortably beyond their 100th birthdays, with Queen Elizabeth II and Prince Charles also faring quite healthily as later recruits to the cause of homeopathy. The Order of the Boot. Winston Churchill in opposition. Winston Churchill made his entrance to Westminster Abbey with exquisite timing at the royal wedding of the 20th of November 1947. The former Prime Minister was late, a sheer accident according to his friends, deliberate calculation in the view of his critics, and the entire congregation rose to its feet in salute. "Everyone stood up," reported the diarist Sir Henry Chips Channon, "all the kings and queens." It was difficult to believe this was the man whom the British electorate had flung out of power little more than 2 years earlier.
"Has Winston no shame?" asks Bobberty, Marquess of Salisbury, in episode one of The Crown,
as Peter Morgan imagines how Churchill's principal conservative critic,
might have expressed his disdain.
"He's outrageous," responds Anthony Eden, Churchill's not-so-loyal lieutenant and nominal deputy. "But you have to admire him. Poor old Attlee. No one got up for him."
The Winston Churchill, whom we first meet at the beginning of The Crown, is theoretically a beaten man, no longer Prime Minister but the leader of His Majesty's opposition. As the Second World War had drawn to a close in the spring and summer of 1945, the cross-party coalition government which Churchill had so successfully headed since the dark days of 1940 had started to fracture. The European War had been triumphantly won, and though Japan fought on, the coalition's deputy leader, Clement Attlee, felt the time had come for the Labour Party to strike out on its own again. In the general election that followed, the British electorate resoundingly agreed. They wanted a fresh start, handing Labour a massive 146-seat majority to implement its programme to build a bright new cradle-to-grave welfare state, featuring a free National Health Service along with a massive programme of nationalisation. King George VI offered his departing Prime Minister the knighthood of the Garter, but Churchill declined.
"How can I accept the Order of the Garter," he said a few months later, "when the people of England have just given me the Order of the Boot?"
By October 1951, however, after 6 years of socialist government, Britain had come to view Churchill and conservatism more kindly. Clement Attlee's great reforming administration seemed exhausted by its efforts, and life remained drab for many people, with many items of daily existence from sweets to tobacco still rationed. Labour's promised brave new world had not dawned. As a general election loomed, the Conservatives seemed to offer fresh energy and practical competence, with a commitment to build 300,000 new homes per year. And inside the party, some influential voices argued for finding a new young leader to match. Since 1945, Bobberty Cecil, he became Marquess of Salisbury in 1947, had led a cabal of disaffected younger Tories, plotting how to persuade their revered but ageing leader to resign, or at least delegate day-to-day control of the party to Anthony Eden, the well-respected Foreign Secretary, whom Churchill himself acknowledged to be his designated successor. But the old man would have none of it. He angrily repulsed at least two approaches from his colleagues, while Eden declined to be party to any coup. So it was Winston Churchill who took up residence again in Downing Street on the 26th of October 1951, after the electorate narrowly handed victory to the Tories. Yet the smiles on many Conservative faces were forced. Labour had easily won the popular vote, by 48.8 to 44.3%, and it was only the first-past-the-post constituency system that had given a shaky 17-seat majority to Churchill. Bobberty Salisbury and a growing number of his Conservative colleagues had no doubt that the party's first order of business in victory will be to map out a retirement schedule for their 76-year-old leader, now that Churchill had managed to win what he described as "the last prize I seek." Sporting monarch, King George VI, country gentleman. Whenever the royal train rolled across East Anglia's windswept fens towards his family's Norfolk estate at Sandringham, King George VI would talk of going home. He had been born at Sandringham in December 1895, and 57 years later he would die there, having spent some of his happiest hours striding the Norfolk countryside in his tweed cap and plus fours, a gun in the crook of his arm, scanning the high skies for partridge, coot, or mallard. Born Prince Albert of York, and known to his family as Bertie, the stuttering king played diverse roles in his life. Knock-kneed naval cadet, the last emperor of India, father of Queen Elizabeth II, steady prop to the post-abdication monarchy, and dogged wartime leader. His secret to managing all these parts was that he remained consistently in style and at heart a Norfolk country gentleman. Wolferton Splash was his special pride. On the 19th of January 1915, the Sandringham estate was surprised by one of the first German airship raids on Britain.
The Zeppelins had also bombed the nearby towns of King's Lynn and Great Yarmouth, and there can be little doubt that the German objective at Sandringham was a direct hit on the British royal family. The raiders had previously targeted, and failed to hit, the Belgian royal family at Antwerp. But the bombs only succeeded in cratering the sandy salt marshes along the Wash, and one such crater near the village of Wolferton, the site until the 1960s of the Sandringham railway station, filled up with water and became an attraction for visiting wild duck. That meant that the pond also became an attraction for keen-eyed duck hunters. So when George VI took charge of the estate in 1937, he had Wolferton Splash enlarged, and it became a favourite destination for his winter expeditions. The young Prince Albert of York had started his shooting career near Wolferton at the age of 12, noting the details on the opening page of his brand new game book. December the 23rd, 1907. Sandringham, Wolferton Warren. Papa, David, and myself. One pheasant, 47 rabbits. My first day's shooting. Papa was his father, George V, who inculcated him with his passion for field sports. David was his elder brother, the future Edward VIII, who soon came to find shooting a bore. I used a single-barrel muzzleloader with which Grandpa, King Edward VII, Uncle Eddie, Albert Victor, Duke of Clarence, and Papa all started shooting. I shot 3 rabbits. In the years that followed, the Royal Game Book came to document a tally which, to the non-sporting outsider, can only look like the most indiscriminate slaughter. But shooting is the preserve of the countryman, and as such, George VI became noted for moving the Sandringham agenda away from the formal battues of slow-moving, overfed pheasants that passed for sport in Edwardian times, followed by a marquee lunch served by footmen. He loved rough forays with the estate workers, ranging the countryside to hunt up the hedgerows, pausing only for a quick sandwich and swig from a whiskey flask behind a handy haystack, and he was no fair-weather sportsman. "Snow and very cold east wind," he noted in his game book one January. "I spent 4 hours in a hide in a kale field." Modest and generous to his guests, George VI also abandoned his father's and grandfather's tradition whereby the king took the best place at every stand throughout the day. His last ever day of shooting, on the 5th of February 1952, took the form of his beloved end-of-season rough forays, and the details were not recorded in the game book. But his Norfolk neighbour and fellow sportsman Aubrey Buxton described the scene. "The wide arc of blue sky, sunshine and long shadows, a crispness underfoot, and the call of mating partridges ringing clearly across the broad fields. They were all there, the king's men, his staff, some friends, the keepers, the estate workers, some local policemen and visiting gamekeepers. And so they set off to hunt the hedgerows." Chapter 2. Hyde Park Corner. The King is Dead. On the 5th of February 1952, King George VI, the last Emperor of India and first head of the Commonwealth, stepped out for a bracing expedition of late-season rough shooting through the woods and marshes of his beloved Sandringham. Ever the marksman, he killed 3 hares with his final 3 shots and came home a happy man. A few hours later, at the age of 56, he was dead. The King's valet could not rouse him in the morning. The king had suffered a thrombosis in the night, the aftermath of the drastic lung removal operation he had undergone the previous September in a vain attempt to check the progress of cancer. Outside the circle of royal physicians, only Winston Churchill had been aware of how truly poor the king's health was. But when news of the death reached him on the morning of the 6th of February in Downing Street, sitting up in bed in his pyjamas smoking a cigar and surrounded by state papers, the 77-year-old Prime Minister burst into tears.
"Bad news," he growled. "The worst."
I tried to cheer him up by saying how well he would get on with the new Queen, recalled his private secretary, John Colville, in his diary. But all he could say was that he did not know her and that she was only a child. The king's death triggered a series of procedures bearing the codename Hyde Park Corner, starting with a message cabled out to the British High Commission in Nairobi, Kenya, where Princess Elizabeth had arrived with her husband, the Duke of Edinburgh, 5 days earlier. Deputising for the ailing king, the couple had just completed the first stage of a Commonwealth tour that was due to take them on from Africa to Ceylon, modern Sri Lanka, Australia, and New Zealand. Episode 2 of The Crown depicts the thrilling and quite dangerous final hours that Elizabeth enjoyed in Africa as a princess, surrounded by trumpeting wild elephants, as she made her way with her husband to the legendary Treetops Hotel, built 35 feet up in the spreading boughs of a giant fig tree in Kenya's Aberdare National Park. Many viewers might have imagined that the sequence sprang from the imagination of The Crown's creator, Peter Morgan, but it was, in fact, based on the memories of Colonel Jim Corbett, the British hunter who accompanied the royal couple on the trip. "In the course of a long lifetime, I have seen some courageous acts," Corbett later recounted, "but few to compare with what I witnessed on that fifth day of February, 1952. The princess and her companions, who had never previously been on foot in an African forest, had set out that glorious day to go peacefully to Treetops, and from the moment they left, their ears had been assailed by the rampaging of angry elephants." The royal couple were walking along a narrow jungle track that had been beaten out and was still used constantly by rhinos, buffalo, and elephants. The only human escape routes were ladders that had been nailed to occasional trees along the track. In single file and through dense bush, where visibility in places was limited to a yard or two, continued Corbett, they went towards those sounds, which grew more awe-inspiring the nearer they approached them. And then, when they came to the bend in the path and within sight of the elephants, they found that they would have to approach within 10 yards of them to reach the safety of the Treetops Hotel ladder. A large cow elephant was standing guard over her offspring. "I was sweating blood," said one of the rangers later. But covered by guns, Elizabeth and her husband crossed the glade and climbed the ladder. 1 minute later, the princess was up on the balcony with her cine camera filming the elephants. And so it was in the small hours of the 6th of February 1952 that Elizabeth II became queen while sitting in the branches of a giant fig tree. The moment is marked in The Crown by the flight of a magnificent African fish eagle that appears out of nowhere, hovering and swinging in the air above the princess, an eerie omen of her fate. This sequence is based on another contemporary memory from Commander Michael Parker, the Duke of Edinburgh's naval friend and private secretary, who had persuaded the couple to watch the sunrise over the jungle and was struck by the majesty of the huge bird of prey as it hovered in apparent salute. "I never thought about it until later," he wrote, "but that was roughly the time when the king died." By a strange quirk, however, the new queen was one of the last people in the world to hear the news of her own accession. When the crucial Hyde Park Corner telegram reached Nairobi early on the morning of the 6th of February, the High Commissioner had already left Nairobi with most of his staff, heading for Mombasa, where he was due to bid farewell to his royal guests as they left for Ceylon, and he had taken the official code book with him. Also in Mombasa, packed and ready for the voyage, were many of the items in Elizabeth's formal wardrobe, including the black mourning outfits that travel everywhere with royalty. A telegram to Buckingham Palace ensured that a black hat would be discreetly brought on board the royal plane next day when the Queen got back to London. As the cables piled up in Government House, it was Elizabeth's private secretary, Martin Charteris, who first got wind that something was amiss when he was summoned to a phone in the British Press Centre. There in the booth he found a journalist, looking dazed and white. Blankly turning a packet of cigarettes over and over in one hand, Charteris later remembered. The Reuters wire had just passed on the momentous news from London that the government felt they could keep secret no longer. It was Parker who, alerted by Charteris from the press centre, had to break the news of the king's death to Philip at Sagana Lodge. "He looked as if you'd dropped half the world on him," Parker recalled.
I never felt so sorry for anyone in all my life.
Philip took his wife away from everyone else.
He took her up to the garden, Parker remembered, and they walked slowly up and down the lawn while he talked and talked and talked to her.
When Charteris arrived at Sagana, he found the couple back alone together in the lodge, with Philip lying flat on a sofa, holding a copy of the Times over his face like a tent. The new queen's cheeks were flushed, but there was no sign of tears. She was sitting erect, fully accepting her destiny, recalled Charteris, struck by the composure with which Elizabeth insisted on personally drafting the telegrams of apology to those awaiting her on the next stages of the now-cancelled tour. When the private secretary asked her how she wished to be known as queen, her regnal name, she answered briskly, "Oh, my own name. What else?" Elizabeth II left Sagana in the blue jeans she had worn at Treetops, requesting that the three press photographers present should not take any photographs. "We stood silently outside the lodge as the cars drove away in a cloud of dust," recalled one of them, John Joachimson, "not one of us taking a shot at that historic moment. Seeing the young girl as Queen of Great Britain as she drove away, I felt her sadness as she just raised her hand to us as we stood there silent, our cameras on the ground." On the long 19-hour overnight flight back to London, Philip's valet, John Dean, noticed how the new queen left her seat once or twice. When she returned, he thought she looked as if she had been crying, but no one saw any tears. Philip's cousin, Pamela Mountbatten, who had come on the trip as a lady-in-waiting, remembers Elizabeth apologizing for spoiling the exciting South Pacific voyage to which everyone had been looking forward.
"I'm so sorry that we're all going to have to go home," she had said as they left Sagana.
Elizabeth II's reluctance to play the top potato will prove a defining characteristic of her low-key style as monarch, along with her dry sense of humour. As the aircraft finally taxied to a halt at Heathrow Airport, she looked out of the window at the line of large, black official cars waiting.
"Look," she said, "they've sent the hearses."
A memorable scene in episode 2 of The Crown shows the interior of the Royal DC-4, a propeller plane, as it taxis to a halt beside the waiting line of bareheaded dignitaries in the early evening dusk of the 7th of February at London Airport. Tommy Lascelles has come aboard to take charge of the protocol, and he blocks the Duke of Edinburgh as Philip moves forward to accompany his wife down the air stairs to the tarmac.
"No, sir, if you don't mind," says Lascelles, "the Crown takes precedence."
Did it happen exactly like that? The details are not recorded. But that, or some similar process of discussion, produced the moving image of the young Queen, not Elizabeth Mountbatten or Elizabeth Windsor, but now a newly minted person, Elizabeth Regina, Elizabeth the Queen, dressed in black and descending the stairs quite alone to meet her Prime Minister and government. It was, observed the diplomat Sir Evelyn Shuckburgh, the 20th century version of Lord Melbourne galloping to Kensington Palace, falling on his knees before Victoria in her nightdress. When Elizabeth arrived back at Clarence House, her first visitor was her grandmother, Queen Mary, who had come straight round from Marlborough House next door. All her life, Elizabeth had curtsied to her grandmother, but now their roles were reversed.
"Her old granny and subject," declared Queen Mary with pride and sorrow, "must be the first to kiss her hand."
The following day, the 8th of February 1952, the new Queen's first official act was to meet with her accession council in St. James's Palace. "By the sudden death of my dear father," she told them, "I am called to assume the duties and responsibilities of sovereignty. My heart is too full for me to say more to you today than that I shall always work, as my father did throughout his reign, to uphold constitutional government and to advance the happiness and prosperity of my peoples, spread as they are all the world over.
I know that in my resolve to follow his shining example of service and devotion, I shall be inspired by the loyalty and affection of those whose queen I have been called to be. I pray that God will help me to discharge worthily this heavy task that has been laid upon me so early in my life.
The Queen's entrance, wrote the future Prime Minister Harold Macmillan in his diary, the low bows of her councillors, the firm yet charming voice in which she pronounced her allocution and went through the various ceremonious forms of the ritual, produced a profound impression on us all. Britain was still in the grip of post-war austerity, and Macmillan thought that the assembled politicians in their dark coats and striped trousers presented rather a scruffy, scrubby appearance. He also noted that while the new monarch was being proclaimed Queen Elizabeth II by the grace of God, Queen of this realm, and of all her other realms and territories, the Scots would argue that she was, in fact, only Queen Elizabeth I of Scotland, since Scotland did not join the Union until 1603. Churchill later compromised on this dilemma by deciding that the royal style in Scotland would be ER for Elizabeth Regina. There must have been nearly 200 Privy Councillors present, recalled Oliver Littleton, Secretary of State for the Colonies. The door opened, and the Queen in black came in. Suddenly the members of the Privy Council looked immeasurably old and gnarled and grey. The Queen made one of the most touching speeches to which I have ever listened, and I, like many others, could hardly control my emotions. Convened only once at the start of every reign, the Accession Council is made up of Privy Councillors, many of them former or current Cabinet Ministers, great officers of state, the Lord Mayor and Aldermen of the City of London, some senior civil servants and representatives of the Commonwealth. Its principal role is to prepare and sign the Accession Proclamation, to be read out from the balcony of St. James's Palace and at other spots around the country.
It was a very moving occasion, wrote Vincent Massey, the new Governor-General of Canada. A slight figure, dressed in deep mourning, entered the great room alone, and with strong but perfectly controlled emotion, went through the exacting task the Constitution prescribes. Her speeches were perfectly delivered. After this, Prince Philip stepped forward quietly and went out of the door with her.
Behind the scenes, meanwhile, Churchill's mutinous cabinet considered the political implications of the change of monarch. Led by Foreign Secretary Sir Anthony Eden, a cabal of senior conservatives felt that the 77-year-old Prime Minister was losing his faculties and should be replaced by a younger, more dynamic leader, Eden himself, in fact. On the day following the King's death, Churchill had overslept and failed to chair the cabinet meeting that he himself had summoned.
Being much tired, according to Harold Macmillan, with the emotion of yesterday.
Anticipating that the accession of the new young queen would show up the old warrior's frailties, his critics looked forward to the broadcast that he had to prepare at short notice in praise of the late king, confident that he would mix up his words or forget his lines. At one point during the speech, their hopes seemed justified.
"My friends, no minister," declared Churchill in his live BBC